from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3 years ago, Tahrir Square in Cairo erupted in joy when strongman Hosni Mubarak surrendered power. It's been a tough path for Egypt since, including another leader ousted, and now the third vote in 3 years on a new constitution, yet another. This one validating that military ouster of President Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. Is Egypt back where it started? And what happened to the dream of Tahrir? This hour on Point Egypt Now, from Tahrir Square to hard realities. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's happened in Egypt? Is the dream of the Arab Spring dead? On hold. We will talk in this hour with the producer of the newly Oscar-nominated documentary, The Square, Karim Amir, nominated just this morning for Best Documentary Academy Awards. But first, with us from Cairo is Nancy Youssef, Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
So 2 days of voting, and everyone seems to presume that this referendum will give the vote to the new constitution.
That's right. I mean, that was a presumption even before the balloting count of the ballots began, because the media campaign here was so aggressive, urging people to vote, that voting yes was a reaffirmation of the 25th of January revolution in 2011, a reaffirmation of what they call the second revolution on June 30th, the one that led to Mohamed Morsi's ouster. And frankly, there was a feeling that those who voted no, there was a fear at least that they could face arrest, and they certainly were silence in terms of posting campaign posters and outwardly urging people to vote no. And so the assumption had always been that this would go forward. And the initial count puts the approval as high as 98%.
Is the military treating this as indeed a kind of affirmation by the public that it's acted correctly, that is now that its position is now legal, that it's at the top of the pyramid?
That's right. And also that it's the sort of a count and a referendum, if you will, on General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the Minister of Defense and the de facto leader of Egypt, the one who announced Morsi's ouster and the suspension of the Morsi constitution. He's the presumed frontrunner for the still unannounced presidential elections here. And so this vote was, in a sense, about everything but the constitution, about where Egypt is, the state of the military on Sisi. And for some, the sort of death knell for the Muslim Brotherhood and its vision for Egypt.
Now, the constitution itself is, I'm reading here, very much like the one that was passed under the Muslim Brotherhood, but that it's not as, it doesn't put Sharia law, Islamic law, quite so large here, and it lets the military appoint its own defense secretary, which means nobody is above it.
That's right. In fact, the new constitution allows the current Minister of Defense, Sisi, to remain in office for 8 years, regardless of who's elected president. And so it begs the question, what would happen if he did run? Certainly, it suggests that he would have a say in terms of who would become the defense minister if he became president. And it really reaffirms the military's grip back on the governance of this country. I think what's confusing for so many people is this is essentially the use of a democratic process to affirm the return of a quasi-police state.
To bring back a police state. I want to hear a couple of voices here on that and get your sense of how Egyptians are thinking about this. Here's an Egyptian vendor, Ramadan Fati, talking with Agence France-Presse in Cairo while he was waiting in line to vote, saying, good thing, good for the country. Here he is.
I'm very hopeful. I'm a vendor and the situation is tough. We've got kids, rent, schools to pay, and we want something to push the country forward, not to pull it back.
People looking there for stability, for something that goes forward. It has been a time of turmoil. But on Tuesday, speaking in London, Mohamed Soudan, Foreign Relations Secretary of the Freedom and Justice Party, that's the political wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, told the BBC that 7 months after the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, Egypt is worse for all of its citizens.
7 months now. Protesting in the street. Economy is down. Everything is bad in Egypt. Life is very, very hard in Egypt. Compare the 1 year of Morsi, even there is any kind of failing in the leadership of the Dr. Morsi, and 7 months now. What is the difference? Now we are very, very bad reputation country. No democracy, no free speech.
No democracy, no free speech. The Muslim Brotherhood and more boycotted this vote, Nancy. Can you tell how successful that boycott was?
Well, I can tell you, having been here for 2 years and covered several elections, that anecdotally, the polling stations were not as full as they once were. The ballot boxes were not as full as they once were. And the process was not as transparent as it had been in the past, where we had thousands, 16,000 monitors in the past. We had a fraction of that number this time. And so it certainly felt different in the sense of a transparent, open process, one where there was suspense, if you will. This time, everybody went in knowing the results. And the only question was how many people would come out to vote and how big the margin would be in favor of the Constitution. So it certainly felt different. That said, the government position is that the turnout was higher this time than it was during the 2012 vote for the Morsi Constitution, with no real independent monitors consistently at the polling stations. There's no way to question or validate that number.
Nancy, General Sisi, who's at the top here, has said that he would run for president if the people asked him to. Does it appear that he will take this vote as that request? And if there's an election for president, when would that be?
Well, we're still waiting to find out. There's been some discussion about whether there'd be parliamentary elections first or presidential election first. I should note that Sisi's remarks, that you referred to, he made, I believe, a week ago, are very reminiscent of Gamal Abdel Nasser's comments, who was the first president of Egypt after the overthrow of the king. He took office in 1954, and he used that language as well. And it's important because one of the things that Sisi has been trying to do and the military has been trying to do is to remind Egypt of a time when the military had liberated them, had brought them a freedom and an independent state. And so it's very interesting when you go to places like Tahrir Square, you'll see posters featuring Sisi's picture, and alongside of it is Nasser's picture and not Mubarak. So that language was very reminiscent of that and in line with that the love that many people here have for Nasser. We don't know when elections will be. We expect an announcement in the next few weeks about that. The original announcement when the government was Morsi government was overthrown that we would have elections by February. It doesn't seem that we're on the schedule to do that, but you never know in Egypt.
Nancy Youssef saying their democratic process has been used to bring back a police state. Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers in Cairo. Nancy Youssef, great always to have you with us. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
We will talk in a moment with Karim Amir, producer of the newly Oscar-nominated documentary The Square, nominated this morning for Best Documentary. But first, joining me now from Doha, Qatar, is Shadi Hamid, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center, fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Shadi Hamid, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Is Egypt back where it started under Hosni Mubarak three years ago now, nearly?
No, I would actually say no. I think it's considerably worse. I mean, on any conceivable indicator, Egypt is more oppressive today than it was under Mubarak. I mean, for example, under this new military regime, you have mass killings and what is considered, what Human Rights Watch has called the worst massacre in modern Egyptian history, which happened on August 14th. Mubarak was an autocrat, but he didn't really kill people in the streets. There was some toleration of the opposition, within limits, of course. But now even the most mild opposition is being criminalized. I mean, when it gets to the point where people are putting no posters to encourage people to vote against the Constitution, and that's grounds for arrest, then that tells you something very troubling is going on, and anyone who is caught in a peaceful protest is also potentially subject to arrest. And it's not just affecting Islamists now, but increasingly liberals who are publicly opposing the military are finding themselves in a similar problem. So there really isn't any parallel to what we're seeing now. We'd have to go back to the 50s and 60s under Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Shadi, you've written recently that since the military coup last July that put Mohamed Morsi out of power, the American Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, has spoken more than 25 times to General al-Sisi in Cairo. That's a lot of consultation. In those phone calls and publicly, what's the U.S. saying here? Is Washington pulling in behind this military power or resisting it?
So in all of these calls, Hagel has been stressing the importance of an inclusive process of returning on the democratic path. But it's mostly just rhetoric. If you actually look at what the U.S. has done, they've done very little to back up the rhetoric with meaningful policy changes. There was a largely symbolic suspension of military assistance in October, but it has no significant impact on the Egyptian military, and it seems like it will resume in the coming months anyway. And when you have a situation where John Kerry, America's top diplomat, is going to Egypt and praising the military and saying that the roadmap is moving in the right direction and that the military is restoring democracy, then I think that sends a message that the military in Egypt can get away with nearly anything. I mean, when you're committing massacres in broad daylight, and even that doesn't trigger an aid suspension, a real aid suspension from the U.S., then you know that the U.S. simply isn't serious about really putting pressure on Egypt at this point. There's a variety of reasons for that, of course.
Karim Amer, producer of the documentary The Square, joins us in just a moment. But remember back to how this was. This is February 1st, 2011, an Egyptian woman interviewed by a CNN reporter in Tahrir Square as protesters massed to demand the resignation of then strongman leader Hosni Mubarak.
How do you feel? I mean, when you see your country like this, what goes through your mind?
I'm proud. I'm proud. I'm Egyptian now. Only now I'm very proud that I'm Egyptian.
You weren't proud before?
No.
And now you're proud?
Yes.
And then came that night, just days later, massive crowds in Tahrir Square roaring with triumph when Mubarak stepped down, February 2011. There were documentary makers in that crowd. The producer of that documentary is with us. The Square followed a small group of protesters from the first big Tahrir Square demonstrations to the fall of Morsi. Here from The Square, young protester Aida El-Kashif, standing in Tahrir Square on the night Mubarak would resign, described how that movement had grown.
At first, we were just sleeping on newspapers, and we didn't have any blankets, only a few, and only a few people slept in. Now it's turning into sub-community, it's more tense. The relationships are becoming very strong. We're waiting for him to resign tonight. Waiting. I don't know, we're all very nervous.
Shadi Hamid, please stand by in Doha. With us right now from New York City, producer of that documentary, The Square. Just today, this morning, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. A.O. Scott of The New York Times says it's a fearless exercise in political reportage. Feels like a revelation, records the gruesome collision, Scott writes, of utopian aspirations with cold political realities. But not a despairing film when made. Karim Amer is producer. He joins us from New York. Karim Amer, thank you very much. Congratulations on your Academy Award nomination.
Thank you so much. It's really very fresh news, and I'm honored to be on this call with you guys right now and to be sharing this moment with all of you. As we were just saying earlier, this is Jahan and I are just the representatives of this story. This is a story that was a film that was made from Tahrir Square. It's a story of the people, by the people, by an all-Egyptian team. And, it's this nomination isn't just for us. It's for all of them. And it's for all the people who believed in the dream of Tahrir and who called Tahrir home. So this is for them.
Jahan Najim, director of The Square. A.O. Scott says it's not a despairing film, but of course the filming was done a while ago now. You're watching developments in these very days along with us. You're just back from Egypt, Karim. Are you despairing now for Egypt?
I think that Egypt is in a dark moment right now. There's no denying that. But I think this movement has always come in waves, and it's always been a few steps forward and a few steps backwards. And I think that that's the realities of most change movements. I think that we have to really free ourselves of this romantic idea that the revolution happens and the people come down and they topple the dictator and democracy flourishes overnight. I think it's a long road. It's a difficult road. But what keeps me optimistic is some of the young people who we followed for over 3 years, and so many of the other people that we met in that square. those people who are unwilling to relinquish that dream, those people who are who will keep standing, who keep fighting, who keep pushing, and are relentless in their spirit. And I think that as all great change movements and as the civil rights movement proved and so many other movements, whether it was apartheid or Irish independence, that it's always the dedicated few that make the great change. And so I'm optimistic that in the long run, Egypt will get to where so many hoped and dreamed for.
We want to hear that perspective, interact with kind of foreign policy, maybe drier analysis of Shadi Hamid. I don't mean try in a bad way, Shadi, but the film in many ways foreshadows what's happened. Here's a little bit from, this is a protester in the squares. Following here, Khalid Abdallah, this is a British Egyptian actor, starred in movies like The Kite Runner and United 93. Shortly after the fall of Mubarak, from the documentary The Square, here's Khalid presciently talking about his concerns for the future from Tahrir Square post-Mubarak.
The expectation at first was that he would go and then we'd all move on or find a way of doing things. Now, if he just goes and someone comes in his place and we have the whole same regime underneath him, then we have a major problem. It just becomes like, you know, that we did all of this in order just to remove him and put someone exactly like him in his place. If we still have a police state, if we still have emergency law, if we still have the constitution pretty much the same as it is, then if we had an election in 6 months' time, the situation would pretty much be the same because the tools of the state remain the same.
From the documentary The Square, nominated today for an Academy Award, Shadi Hamid, you can hear Karim Amir still with that faith that there's something burning here that is not extinguished. What about that? What to your eyes, Shadi, was the moving spirit of Tahrir Square? The whole world witnessed. And where is that now, Shadi?
Well, I remember, too, I was in the square when Mubarak fell as well. I remember overhearing Egyptians saying that they've never been happier in their life and never been more proud. So I remember that kind of spirit. But and I do agree with Karim that in the long run, Egypt will, you know, I think it's just a question of how long is the long run? Is it 30 years? Is it 40 years? And I think the problem here is that, you know, the revolutionaries failed, and we have to kind of ask ourselves how that really happened, and perhaps something can be learned from it. But what I think is so troubling now is that Egyptian society and the Egyptian media is demonizing the revolutionaries. I mean, put the Brotherhood to the side for a second. The fact that one of the leading figures of the revolution, the founder of April 6th, was just sentenced to 3 years in prison, that tells you something, and there was very minimal fallout. So I think the interesting question for me is, how is it possible that millions of people who felt this fire, this desire for democracy, could just 3 years later, many of them, turn their back on that very same dream and support what is effectively a military dictatorship? And I think we also have to acknowledge that many of the so-called revolutionaries and liberals, people who we hailed, actually supported the military coup on July 3rd and were silent or actually supportive when hundreds were killed on August 14th in the mass killing at Rabah. So I think that kind of puts us in a very difficult position where we have to ask, how do people accept these things after they had a glimpse of freedom and democracy in 2011? And I think that's what's so dark about this.
Karim Amir, how do you explain that?
Well, I mean, I think that. You know, I think that there's a battle of narratives that's been happening from the get-go. I think that what happened in that square was an attempt by Egyptians to challenge the narrative that so many people had been trapped in, which was one where hope had been lost and the future had already been written and young people didn't have much opportunity in the country. I think that in the land of the pharaohs, for the first time, the pyramid was turned upside down and people had, you know, there was a sense of agency that was created for the bulk of Egyptians. I think that feeling and that taste of freedom and democracy or whatever you want to call it is something that fundamentally changed a lot of people. And they will come back and they will act again, as we've seen in other dark moments, you know, after Maspero, when you had tanks running over people in broad, you know, over the Coptic Christian March, nothing happened the next day or the next week. And it was one of the darkest moments. This is in October 2011. People thought that the revolution was over and nobody cared. And then, you know, shortly afterwards, you saw this second wave come through. And so I'm optimistic that there is another wave that will be coming. And I also think that, you know, this whole this hype about the military coming back and the military reclaiming power, I think is really a challenging story to kind of look at from that perspective, because the idea that the military left is kind of crazy. The military never left. I don't understand all of the analyst work that keeps talking about how the military is coming back. The military never left. The coup didn't start this summer, you know, in Rabat. The coup started, shortly after after Mubarak left, when less than, as you see in the film, less than 3 weeks after Mubarak left, protesters are arrested again. Rami Assam is tortured in the Egyptian Museum and nobody cares. Virginity tests are conducted. So the coup, and the world was silent then. So the coup started when we turned our back away to Egypt and allowed for the return of this violent face to come back. And so when 2 years later you see them massacring people, well, what do you expect?
But there was joy. There was joy that something had been achieved here, and surely it wasn't joy over a police state or a military dictatorship, as Shadi Hamid describes it.
There was joy. Of course there was joy. You mean when Mubarak left?
Yes.
Yeah, of course there was joy, but the idea that change can happen in 18 days, I think is a fantasy, and I think that's something that we all bought into, both as Egyptians and people on the outside world, and just felt like, okay, well that was a good story. You know, they got rid of Mubarak in 18 days, and now it's over. But I think change takes a lot of time. I think that if you talk to people who have fought for change, whether it was in the civil rights movement and other popular movements, whether it's in the Ukraine and other countries, they will all tell you the same thing, that it is a very difficult path, and that it's not clear, and that your victory is in the middle. Oftentimes, you don't even realize the victories you've accomplished when you're in the midst of it. So I think that it is a difficult path, and we're seeing a kind of counter wave right now. And there's no denying, though, that the bulk of Egyptians, you know, I was just there, are supporting the military, and they did vote for yes. But again, why is this shocking to us? Every single constitutional vote we've had has been yes, you know, and yes isn't just about reaffirming the control of the military. Yes in Egypt today just means people want the country to move forward. I mean, I know many people who voted yes during the Morsi constitutional referendum, many of them who had voted for Shafiq and had no interest in Morsi, but they just want the country to move forward. So I think we have learned in these 3 years that Egyptians will vote yes when it comes to the constitution, because yes means green light. It means moving forward. But at the same time, I think that the resilience of this movement has shown that even in its darkest moments, even when it's seemed completely defeated, that the hopes and aspirations of young Egyptians are not going to be stopped by any one document or any one vote.
Reform in the long run, then, I guess you're saying. But that could be a very long time. Shadi Hamid's saying, what is it going to be? 30, 40, 50 years? They won't be young Egyptians then.
No, I don't think it's 30, 40, 50 years. I think that at the end of the day, we have to remember that what sparked this revolution was the economic conditions of most Egyptians, right? The first battle cry of the revolution was Aish, bread, freedom and social justice, you know. And freedom in Egypt isn't just freedom of speech. It's the ability to afford housing, the ability to have health care, the ability to provide education for your children. So I think that the hopes and aspirations of Egyptians, what they feel is rightfully theirs, because of the sense of agency that the protest movement achieved in Tahrir Square, has not been relinquished. And that is something that, regardless of who wins the next election, they will have to face. And I think that the army is playing a very dangerous game now with trying to kind of control all of the tools of the state. And they will be, you know, as you see in the film, Ahmed, when he was asked about when the protesters felt defeated completely by the Brotherhood victory in the elections, we filmed him, and he was talking to two friends, and he was saying, you know, look, the Brotherhood, they took the parliamentary elections, They took the upper house and the lower house. They took the presidential election. So that's it. Now they're responsible for the country. So they have inherited the brunt of responsibility for all the people's frustrations. The same thing is now happening with the military. If they take over every aspect of the Egyptian governance, then they will be held completely responsible. And then there's no one else to blame after that. So I think that there will be a process of correction. I think that there will be a process of reduction of the military state, because the Egyptian people...
Just jump in.
Yeah, one second. Sure. Egyptian American Karim Amir, there, producer of The Square. Shadi, what are you thinking?
Yeah, so I think sometimes repression works. I mean, you can terrify enough people into silence, and there have been other transitional cases, particularly in Latin America, where you have revolutions and democratic openings followed by terrible periods of brutal repressive rule. If we look at Chile and Argentina, there was a military coup against a democratically elected president in 1973, and Augusto Pinochet was in power for 17 years after that. So people can revolt, but then very quickly, go back into silence because they want stability at any and all costs, and they're just tired of going out in the street. They're tired of opposing things. So we shouldn't underestimate the staying power of autocratic regimes when they have a popular base of support. The other thing, too, is there is regional and international backing for the military in Egypt, certainly from Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but also, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. isn't interested in putting much pressure on the Egyptian government. So this isn't the best international context for democracy.
Because there is a lot of support and not a lot of opposition. Karim, what do you think about the U.S. position at this point? Shadi Hamid saying essentially it's accepting.
Well, I mean, I think that, I think that there is an attempt. There's been an attempt from the beginning to whitewash history and to kind of, whether it's been by the Brotherhood or by the military, either group when they've come into positions of power, have tried to kind of completely whitewash history and clean their hands of any wrongdoings. And I think that that's, for me as a filmmaker and as someone who's been part of a team that's been trying to document what's been happening, what's really exciting about getting the film out there right now is and getting this support and even being on this radio show is that we're bringing attention back to the story, and we're helping level the playing field and showing that the narrative is no longer going to be written by who controls the tools of the country, and that we are living in this borderless world where people, one camera, one image, one upload can make a difference and fight back against the narratives being told. I think that part of what was trying to be broken in that change of narrative in Egypt was a break between the choice that has always been given to Egyptians and always been presented to America, which is that the only options in Egypt are the military or the Brotherhood. And I think that there is a lot of effort to go back to that narrative and for Egyptians to be stuck there again. I think that the American foreign policy on Egypt has, and on the Arab Spring, has always been a little bit of a little too late.
Karim Amir, stand by right there. We'll come back to it. Producer of the, as of today, Academy Award-nominated documentary, The Square, joining us today from New York, Shadi Hamid in Doha. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt, its uprisings, dreams, its reality now. As the elections got going in Cairo, here was an Egyptian man interviewed here by France 24, saying that those who opposed the Constitution had not been able to express their dissent without being targeted by the regime. Here he is, interpreted by France 24.
There have been cases of people from the Revolutionary Front being arrested. They are now in the regime's jails because they went into the streets to say no to the Constitution, giving out stickers and posters saying no to the Constitution.
They resisted, they're in jail. But there is also support in the streets. People just tired of chaos. Speaking with NPR's Leila Fadel on Tuesday, an Egyptian woman in Cairo said she supported General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and hoped he would run for president.
There is a person who the whole nation love him. This is el-Sisi. We need a strong president at the moment to be able to keep the country together.
My guests today are calling that police state, military dictatorship. Shadi Hamid and Karim Amir, stand by. Lots of people have been calling. Let's bring them. Nate in Milwaukee. Thanks for calling, Nate. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I was going to point out that in the past, I think that this happened because of a failure on two groups. The democracy activists, I think, could have won the election for president had they consolidated behind a single candidate, and they failed to do that.
You mean they could have won over the Muslim Brotherhood candidate?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
I think they could have. And then the Muslim Brotherhood not only failed because it had the entire state responsibility, but because they didn't keep promises and they lost their legitimacy, which an alliance with the democracy activists could have provided them. And from now on out, I wonder if there is a glimmer of hope in that if continued elections are fair and honest, that you could slowly see candidates elected who would relax the police state with time.
Let us pick those up, Nate. Very good questions all. Karim, first to you on, did the democracy activists who you chronicle, and more, of course, in the film, did they have a chance that they blew? Could they have had the first freely elected president of Egypt instead of the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think that they're, you know, one of the battles we've been fighting in Egypt, and one of the battles of this revolution has been a generational one. I think there's no denying that. I think that there is a divide on all fronts. Whether you look at the military, the liberal arms, the brotherhood, between the older generations and the younger generations, between a dream of what young people think is potentially possible in Egypt, and between a reality of what a lot of the leadership in these positions are stuck in, and what they think is the only way Egypt can move forward. And I think that that's been a constant clash, and I think that you always find that there's more in common between the younger generations than there is between the overall sides in general. And so, yes, was there a failure in cooperation? Absolutely. I mean, if you tally the votes of the first round of elections, the candidates in the middle, Amr Musa and Abdul Manam Abu Futuh, and you find that they had a large amount of supporters, and that their lack of cooperation is what allowed for the vote, presidential vote, to become so divisive, and to have these two people on the extremes of both sides become the prime candidates. So I think there is a failure in leadership. I mean. To me, it comes down, actually, this may be funny to some, but I think it's a failure in the Egyptian male ego. I think that we have to really reassess that male ego and its failure to kind of have any kind of cooperation or any kind of ability to compromise. And I think it's, it could be a male problem. We find a lot of senior leadership positions. In this country, when the government shut down, was it not female senators who got together and were able to see eye to eye across the policy divides?
Yes, so, I guess. If I may, Shadi, what about the notion of the possibility of a ballot box evolution away from the police state? Do you believe in that, Shadi, or is the deep state too strong to let that happen?
I mean, it's certainly possible over time. I don't think it will happen right away. But the question is, will real opposition parties be allowed to contest elections, not this year, but let's say in future years? That's the big question. I mean, will the military allow groups like the Muslim Brotherhood or proxies of theirs to re-enter the political process and actually have a chance of winning? And then if they do well in elections, then you're kind of back to square one. What happens if Islamists come to power and the military doesn't like that? Then that still is the issue that has to be resolved. And if I could just add one thing, mm-hmm. when it comes to cooperation, and Karim touched on this, is that I think it's worth keeping in mind the Muslim Brotherhood and the revolutionaries were working hand in hand in Tahrir Square in 2011. There was a brief moment of unity, but they couldn't sustain that, and they started to dislike or even hate each other over time. And that gets at something, I think, very deep in these societies. You have Islamists and you have liberals or secularists, and they might be against one dictator, but once that dictator is gone, they have very different worldviews about the role of religion in public life, about the meaning of the nation state. I mean, these are very fundamental issues that are very difficult to resolve, and it's going to take Egypt I think, a long time to sort out these issues. And that's why transitions like these can and often are very difficult.
If indeed we have a transition, Karim, you know, that
goes. I just
want
to say something on that.
Yes,
because,
please.
So, I mean, I think that there was a unity in Tahrir between the Muslim Brotherhood and the revolutionaries, and I think that, you know, if we look at what's happened, I mean, I think that there was, you know, I think that once we left Tahrir, I mean, even the army stood with the revolutionaries in Tahrir in the beginning, right? So I think that once we left Tahrir, the two groups that really took advantage and really betrayed kind of this idea of unity whereas first the army and then the Brotherhood. And they both kind of saw the democratic process as a wooden ladder, a one-way street to get what they wanted out of it. And in doing so, really undermined the whole process. I mean, that's not to say that the revolutionaries were not at fault as well in several times and could have done a much better job at forming coalitions and coming together. However, I don't believe that either the military or the Muslim Brotherhood had any interest in really creating a true democratic process in Egypt. And I think if you look at the organizational structure of both organizations, you'll find that these two organizations are both built on a command-based system, a very centralized power, whether it's Sisi or in the military, or whether it's El Murshid, the supreme guide in the Brotherhood. Both organizations are built on, you know, obedience and do not really promote any kind of democratic process within them or even any way of holding power accountable.
So let me put to you, here we are 3 years after the Arab Spring. A lot of people abroad in the United States are no doubt looking at this and seeing what Shadi's describing there, this the tension between Islamists and secularists or liberals that militaries all over the Middle East have taken advantage of for so long. Does that perpetually wound or undermine democracy in this region, Karim? Is that just, you know, unescapable?
I think that, you know, look, you know, it took this country how many years to get from the American Revolution to the actual formulation of the Constitution? You know, I think that once again, we have this really, you know, fast track program in our mind that people can just, you know, spring out democracy. And American foreign policy is always based on this idea of, you know, throwing together an election and then that being the only measurable result. And as we see the election processes in Egypt and in Afghanistan and in Iraq have all failed. So, I mean, I think, you know, building democracy on the basis of just who wins an election when you don't have the other tools of the state set up leads us to a kind of failed state situation or a failed democracy process. And that's not to say that democracy will fail in the Middle East or that the Middle East isn't ready for democracy, but I think that it is the Middle East it is the local populations that will decide. I think that, you know, what happened on as the gentleman who called earlier from and asked about, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood losing legitimacy on you know what mm-hmm. what happened on June 30th when millions of Egyptians came down to the street is that they said we do not want you know, people to use religion this way. And to me, what will be looked at on that date from 10 years to come is that was the rewriting of the role of religion in society. That was our separation of church and state, you know. Now, what happened after that is, of course, completely unacceptable.
Sorry,
you know,
Kareem,
and how the military
Kareem,
took advantage
that
of that.
Shadi? It happened last summer.
When people went out on June 30th, they weren't, for the most part, going out because they believed in the separation of mosque and state. Most were coming out because for economic reasons, the lack of stability, they felt that things weren't moving forward. If you look at the major demands of Tamarrud, the main movement that was supporting the June 30th mass protest, none of them had to do with the role of religion. So I think we shouldn't read too much into that. The ordinary person who was going out was not calling for secularism. So I just wanted to jump in there on that.
Let me get it.
I disagree with that, actually. I think that when people saw that the Brotherhood was peddling democracy and religion together and using mosques to push their way forth and really, you know, religion is held as something very sacred in Egypt. You know, whether you're Muslim or Christian, we are a religious country. But people saw an exploitation of that very sacred piece of us and an attempt by political religious groups to really exploit it in a way that really didn't settle well. And when there, and yes, Shetty, there was an economic drive, and I think that when people found that not only are you hijacking the democratic process, but you're also now bringing no economic returns. And you're also claiming to be the moral authority on religion. They said, no, not in my name. And that's why you saw people chanting in the streets, let the sheikhs go back to the mosques. So I think that we had to go through that cycle, though, and as we say in Arabic and Egypt, lazim idak tatlisa, you have to like burn your fingers to feel to learn from that. And I think that the same thing is going to happen with the military. I think that the military is once again going to come in, pretend to be the savior, take on every power in the country, fail at that, and then people will come down and say, no, this isn't what we want either. And then hopefully we'll get to the stage of having an egalitarian society where we realize that no one can rule Egypt alone. And then unless we create a space for everyone to be involved, whether it's the military or the Brotherhood or whatever group, to be involved and to create that society that is representative of the country, that is inclusive, that dream of Tahrir, then the country is not going to move forward. And I think that people will keep fighting until we get to that stage.
Karim Amir not giving up here. Fascinating angles of interpretation. Sean in Lexington, Kentucky. Sean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Two quick and related questions. I lived in the Middle East in the early 90s when Mubarak had broad-based support and was praised for crushing an outbreak of domestic terrorism. You know, he was praised for supporting the rights of religious minorities. He was somewhat tolerant of criticism. And the only folks that were really speaking or claiming that they were repressed were supporters of the more radical elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. My first question, what changed? And the second question is, why are we promoting democracy when our own forefathers spoke out against democracy without Western-style constitutional civil rights? Great show. Thanks.
Sean, thanks for your call. Shadi, is the basis there, I guess, in the first place, Sean is asking, to build on? Karim is describing it being built slowly, with difficulty, but being built. Our caller Sean expressing skepticism there that you've got a foundation you can build it on.
Well, you can't force people to be liberals. Yes, the West has a tradition of constitutional liberalism, but it's up to Egyptians to decide how liberal they want to be. And if the vast majority of Egyptians, as all the polls we have make clear, see an important role for Islam and Islamic law in public life, then you can't just force them to change their mind. And that's why in five consecutive elections since the 2011 uprising, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists won each and every time. I mean, there's a reason for that, not just mobilization and organizational prowess, but also because there is a general sympathy to this idea that Islam has a certain role to play. Now, it's possible that could change over time, but it's not as if we can copy and paste the Western experience and tell Egyptians, you all have to be liberals before we can give you democracy. And that was always what Mubarak had argued for, that Egyptians aren't ready because, you know, Islamists will come to power and the fundamentalists and all of this. And this was the whole basis of the very gradualist argument that you have to wait 10, 20, 30 years, and then maybe then you can have free elections for Egyptians. I think that is, first of all, it's patronizing and offensive. And secondly, the only way you can learn democracy is by practicing it and doing it. And as bad of a president as Morsi was, and he messed things up, and he wasn't the right person at the right time, at least under Morsi, the opposition had a chance. They could oppose him publicly without being killed or being thrown in prison for the most part. So there was at least still hope that they were going to push back against Morsi and claim their own role in the political process. Now, the problem today in Egypt is the opposition has no voice and no recourse. Anyone who speaks out can be arrested. So that's why it's very unfortunate that the democratic process in Egypt, as flawed as it was and as problematic as the Muslim Brotherhood was as a group, that was ended prematurely and wasn't given a chance to develop and mature over time.
Karim, we've just got half a minute here. What about the American role now? Do you see it sliding into a kind of complicit relationship with what's been called a police state in this hour? Will it lean behind those working for democracy? What do you expect from the U.S. and what difference will it make?
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for this. It's been a great talking to all of you about these topics. I think that, you know, look, I think that the relationship, if we want to understand what's happening in Egypt with America, we have to go to the Pentagon. The relationship between the Pentagon and the generals in Egypt is ironclad. It's been so since the Camp David Accords, and it will continue to be so for reasons that, you know, Shadi can probably explain more than I can. But I think that there is a fight against people power, and it's happening in squares across the world. I think that what's happened, Egypt happens to be at the epicenter of many of the world's problems.
Karim, we've got to cut it right there, but we want to congratulate you on your nomination today for the Square Academy Award nomination. Karim Amir, Shadi Hamid, joining us from Doha. Thanks to you both so much for this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.